This is Peter Hill Explains, where I do two things. I try and coach you, expose you to some of the questions at high school level that we teach our students, and I myself, as part of cardiac rehab, improve my ability to explain and coach people. I don't have access to students to individually coach, so I'm coaching, sort of virtual coaching at this point in time. We're going to look at an old exam paper, a very useful thing to do, to do fairly early on in the piece to acclimatise your learning to the end result that you're supposed to get to. Obviously, it's a thing which, obviously, if it takes too long, it takes away from the actual learning process. But here goes. Let's look at some of the questions from the 2017 Medical Physics Options. So an option is a term. If there's four terms and one term, your school can select to do a particular flavour of physics. I think the thinking would be that depending on market demand and market interests, you can actually tune the interest of your teaching to the interests of the students. So these are more interest topics rather than the base topics. So this is medical physics. There's five sections on this, and I'm going to have a go at this. And question A, part one, so it's 32, and then there's five parts to it and subparts to those parts. So part A, subpart one, it reads like this. In an endoscope, how do the arrangement of fibres in coherent and incoherent bundles differ? Okay, so they're asking, how does the arrangement differ? So for incoherent bundles, they're light entering from outside the patient, going to the inside of the patient for the illumination. The fibres are not spatially mapped. You start off with the square, and the square will be arranged to a ring, inward pointing ring. So this is to optimise the light moving in. And for a coherent bundle, that is different because the actual spacing or orientation of the fibres, the image, is the same where the object is imaged. And inside the patient is then mapped to outside the patient. So a camera which sees the light emerging from these regular light pipes is actually seeing basically a pixeled image where the light has been transported along it. That's for 2 marks. I don't have the actual piece of paper here saying how the HSC would say, but I'll continue with it. Part A, subpart 2, explain how light is used to create an endoscopic image. So using ROSA to go backwards, and an endoscopic image is created when light from an external source is transported via light pipes or optical fibres, which employ, so you're trying to explain, employ a process of total internal reflection, which is created or engineered by a core having a higher density than the cladding. I know this because I've worked on optical fibres. And that delivers it to the disease tissue or the thing that you're going to cut up, and then it reflects off that through a lens, and then this is how light is used. Then the light goes to the lens, and so the light is used to illuminate the image, and then the light is used from the image. So keep on saying light is used from the image, and goes through the coherent bundle. Through the light pipes, using again total internal reflection, and then that goes on and is used to illuminate detectors in the back, light detectors in the back of the camera, which is used to produce the direct image. See how I've done on that one. Okay, their official answer for 3 marks is: endoscopy relies on the physical principle of total internal reflection. Light is reflected within each fibre and thereby manipulated. The incoherent bundles provide illumination to the site, which provide a method of illumination. They actually don't provide the illumination, I suppose, to the site, or the end provides illumination, which would be otherwise in darkness. This then permits the coherent bundles to transmit an image to the camera for external viewing. Of course, I would add a bit more by saying that this doesn't give an authorization to these fibers to do it. There's actually a lens system, but I suppose my brain's slightly differently structured from most people. Part B, describe how an ultrasound can be used to measure one property of bone. So working backwards, a property, obviously a property of bone that you want to see with an ultrasound is obviously a break, but also the density. So the property of bone is the density, and this is done by actually putting a transducer, a source, and a receiver on either side, bits of a bone, and actually seeing how much ultrasonic wave is transmitted through it. Depending on the nature of the bone, in generally you will have a greater attenuation through a length of bone. Say at the ankle, you get it on the left inner ankle and the outer bit of the ankle, and you just put an ultrasonic source on either side, actually measure the amount of ultrasound transmitted. The official answer for two is measurement of bone density can be made by directing ultrasound waves at a bone, or through a bone, I would say, they say at, and measuring the amount of waves transmitted. The higher the bone density, the more ultrasound waves are absorbed, and therefore fewer are transmitted. Okay, I've perhaps gone a bit there. Okay, part two. Part two of B. B scans typically use ultrasonic waves of frequency 20 megahertz. I wonder where this is going, because B scan is the brightness scan. B refers to a method of illumination. That's where. An A scan is basically a graph, and you can actually. A graph with X on the bottom, the distance millimeters on the bottom, or it could be time, but millimeters, and you can measure the half width. So something can be a little barely there, but you can see it there and can measure the half width to the peak, or you can measure the peak very accurately. Where you can't do that very easily with a brightness scan. Okay, it's not necessarily to do with the frequency. Whereas a sector scan, that's where the wave is put across, and you can't do an A scan with a sector scan. It just doesn't make sense. You can do a sector scan with numbers, but you can't plot something in two dimensions. You could do a computer-generated image of it, I suppose. I just stack the scans out with a 3D reconstruction, but of course a sector scan is actually a brightness scan. It uses ultrasound waves of frequency 3.5 megahertz, a longer wavelength. Okay, so the shorter wavelength will have higher resolution, but it tends, just the way the body is, that the higher frequencies get attenuated fairly quickly when you get into any serious discontinuities in the tissue. Because so the main thing that ultrasounds do is that they don't, like if you speak, right, you don't get reflections all the way at every single point back in space. You hear it when it hits an interface. It's the major thing of ultrasounds. So I'm giving a bit of a talk while I'm reading this, but here comes the hit question. Account for the use of different frequencies in terms of the purposes of these scans. Well, first off, I'd probably say this is deeply confused. I know from advance that A and B scans tend to be used historically with eye scans, because they're not so much interested in. They know the shape of the eye. They want to know how the retina is or where the lens is to a sub millimeter. Okay. So, but fortunately, they don't say this of these scans. So for the, you have to use their terminology, for the B scan at 20 megahertz, it is used namely in eye scans, because it's got high attenuation, so it can't go very far, but for the eye you don't have to go very far, but it's got a lot of detail because it's high frequency. For 3.5 megahertz, it's got a lot of penetrations in the purposes of looking at embryos, little babies in mums, or the purposes, say, of, I've had recently my kidneys and liver looked at, and gallbladder looked at. It allows you to see a larger distance, but of a slightly lower resolution. See how I did on that one. And they say, B scans are used to examine eyes. Well, that's technically not correct. A brightness scan is the representation of the amount of echo returned to you by the actual brightness of a point. And that is obviously done for all types of scans. If you've got an image, it's a B scan. And therefore, no need to penetrate tissues more than a few centimetres. Wow. Oh, okay. The thing is, it's not necessarily... There is penetration due to attenuation. It's the actual, I suppose, the strength of the signal and the difference. Therefore, high frequencies can obtain a greater detail, which you need in an eye. Sector scans, well, the eye scans are sector scans because they're scanned. I don't know quite where they're going from. Are used to examine tissues deep within the body, e.g. a pregnant uterus, which obviously has an embryo in it. Using a lower frequency, a greater depth of tissue can be examined with less detailed. Okay, my overall problem here is that... you're almost forced to get students to hothouse themselves on the study notes, because the study notes contain the errors or misconceptions which get themselves into the exam. So it takes a lot of the joy out of the place having to read that type of stuff. Okay, part C. Explain how the application of radio frequency waves changes the behaviour of nuclei with net spin, your a net spin in a strong external magnetic field. Okay, so just off the top of your head, working back, in a strong magnetic field, nuclei with a net spin will, due to quantum mechanics, the spin can be either with or against the field. If its north pole of the spin is facing the, is aligned with the north pole of the field, this field, rather than being randomly oriented or oriented with the local magnetic field in the body, it will be tend to be oriented with that field, and that will be at a lower energy. And again, due to quantum mechanics, over time there will be significantly more nuclei at that higher energy. I might give a little talk about this afterwards. Due to physics of spin and angular momentum, this nucleus will orient around at a frequency called the Lamour frequency. So you just basically have to know it. I have a problem here, okay, because they say explain how, and you actually need quantum physics to explain how the radio wave flips it. So a radio wave will flip the nuclei, and the nuclei flipping back and relaxing will do it. So it does two things. Does it flips it, And by flipping it back and forth sufficiently when it's in the right orientation, it will eventually cohere it, make them spin, flip them, and actually also make them spin in the same orientation, the same angle. Keep them in phase, flipped back and forth, and in phase with it due to the Lamor frequency. Now, the actual flipping mechanism is like all things, it's a magnetic dipole transition moment. It's a magnetic dipole, right? Okay, and it's split and it has a transition moment which is calculated by quantum mechanics. But I don't know if that's how. Let's read it here, what their answer is, and then I might give a little talk about it. What is their talk? B scans. So I've got several pages here. Looking at okay, nuclei with a net spin line up with the magnetic field. The orientation may be one of two ways: lower energy spin up of the higher energy and higher energy spin down, with slightly more in the lower energy state. Well, significantly more in the lower energy state. At the same time, the nucleus precess around the direction of B naught with a frequency of the Lamor frequency. You just basically have to rote learn all this. That is dependent on the magnitude of B, the type of nucleus, and the intermediate environment. Well, yeah, the local magnetic field. It's the only thing which comes into it. I just have to remember what the Lamor frequency is. I don't know whether it's got the actual magnitude of spin. Obviously, the magnet. There's a whole lot to it. How much spin's involved? Because obviously, okay, the frequency would be different for phosphor and hydrogen. When radio frequency corresponding to the Lamor frequency is applied, the lowest spin up nuclei absorb energy and flip to the spin down orientation, then precess in phase with each other. Okay, with all the nuclei eventually get shoved in phase. Nuclei which precess at a different frequency are unaffected. Oh, yeah, okay, so the nuclei which either don't precess or precess at a different frequency are not detected. So that's an important point that they actually make, is that, well, no, that's not necessarily. The question is, that's how, what does the radio frequency does? To okay, so it's if the radio frequency and the field is important, i.e. that the radio frequency field and nuclei have to be all added up. So the point I want to make is there's just been a huge amount of misunderstanding. So nuclei can be spin up or spin down, and then you have this thing that the net spin is at 0 degrees. You know, what the heck is going on there? You know, at so you've got 0 to 90 to -90. So it's say it will be the orientation will be say at 80 and spin around, and -80 and spin around. Yet people talk about the spin at 0 degrees and spinning around. What on earth is going on here? And so why do we pick this up? Well, the thing is, the antenna of let's talk through some of this. The antenna of an MRI machine is designed to pick up the XY spin in the XY direction. So this is it, orientation. It's spinning in the orientation like that. And so how do you make a nuclei which can either be at +80 or -80 spin as a single nuclei at 0 degrees? Well, the answer is you can't. But if you get two nuclei, one spin up, one spin down, they're net, and you spin them around together, their net magnetization is in the zero plane. So the idea is that you hit the area with an excitation pulse, and you excite 50-50. Oh, look, it's fairly simple to go through. I don't understand. There are people who just jump into it and explain it too quickly. So you've got 50-50. And if you do this sufficiently for sort of sufficiently long time, back and forth, you'll generate a population which are in phase with exciting radio pulse. I've got to think of the physics of that. So when you switch it off, things will happen. The environment, this is what concerns me about the environment. The environment will tend to dephase it. So there are things in the environment. So if you imagine there are a whole lot of other frequency magnetic fields pulsing around in here, of atoms moving around. It's just the little minor electric fields. So this will cause to interact and dephase it. So this is why I'm concerned with their answer, saying the environment. The environment affects the the dephasing of it. And so there's two things. As things flip up and it rephases, dephases it. The XY component of your synthetic dipole magnetic dipole shrinks and it rings down, and there are two times. One is for it to just simply for the spins to spin up and down, which is just going out, and then there's also another one which builds up in time, which is the dephasing, the T2. I might give a talk on that a bit later on. I don't know how I can introduce it. Okay, so there four. Now we're halfway through. We've done three of the five questions. The fifth question is, describe one way in which X-ray radiation for medical imaging is produced. Well, there's only one way that I do know, is that you, in a vacuum tube, you accelerate electrons to high velocity. The electrons impact a metal. It can be copper, different things. Can be tungsten, refractory metals, depends what you want. If it's a non-refractory metal, you have to have cooling in it, and you often do. I think medical ones tend to go for tungsten and stuff like that. This metal is very important because its inner electrons have a sufficient energy to interact, and you have an electron-electron collision, and the electron ionizes the metal, but by removing an inner shell electron, and when the inner shell electron creates a hole, and electrons from the outer shells drop inwards. It's just a form of standard radiation production by electrons transition between energy levels within an atom. This is what it says. The question says. Well, that's it. That's radiation is produced. It's not how it's filtered or how it's delivered, but that's how it's produced. Let's see how they have answered it. So this is for the first time. Bit of a drum roll as we get through. Good. Okay, I'll read this to you. Electrons are accelerated to high velocities by high voltage. I think I said that, but through an electron gun, high voltage. When they strike the tungsten target, their rapid deceleration produces EMR in the X-ray range of the spectrum. So what they're saying is that X-rays are not produced by knocking out of an inner shell electron, but by something called bremsstrahlung radiation. This is, do you need special relativity? You need some special relativity to explain when you rapidly decelerate a charge, say in a nuclear accelerator or something like that. No doubt there could be some bremsstrahlung radiation, but that's an incorrect statement. Now, what would be interesting is that if that was in the study notes for the guns selective high schools, and they produce that answer, which is incorrect, but they've been given the study notes to produce it. But your average Joe who asks a real physicist, they'll tell you that the electrons are removed. And look, that you have to do. The Brenner-Stahl radiation is a continuum. This X-rays, you tend to want to have elemental spikes and filters in those spikes and absorption in the spikes, so you get fairly much up the a unique radiation. That would be actually quite carcinogenic if you tried to use that type of radiation. Jesus, what the heck is going on there? Yep. Okay. Well, that's... Yeah, that's just... No, that's technically a correct answer. No, it's an incorrect answer. Because that is one way radiation could be produced, but it's not produced for medical imaging. Okay. Why is a CAT scan superior... Why is a CAT scan image superior to a plain X-ray image? So you don't have to talk about how CAT scan... So it's a CAT scan... is there's a X-ray source and an individual X-ray detector on this huge ball bearing, and it's this bearing race, and it spins around you at high speed. I know about it. And they put contrast in you, X-ray contrast in you, and well, that's a very interesting. Well, yeah, and it spins around, and it uses tomography. So a plain X-ray image is basically the shadow cast, is the amount of X-ray which is absorbed for a integral line which goes through you. So it's your belly button, your stomach, your bones, and stuff like that. And there's a lot of image that can be doing, but it's why is it superior? So a CAT scan is superior because by the use of the process of computer-aided tomography, that is, the tomography is slicing, but it's actually not tomography, it's a computer-generated slicing. They infer through a huge amount of redundant data what the actual density is in a pixel of space, and then they can use computers to remove the layers and create an artificial slice or an artificial organ, and artificial in 3D. In fact, I just had my heart done for the operation to check my grafts. I had a second operation, and it's a pretty phenomenal thing that they can do. So a CAT thing can be computer. The image is superior because it's a computer actual slice of it's going on. Let's see what they say. Sorry, there's wind here. X-ray images are formed by shadows cast on film or digital detector, which each point of the image represents all the tissue in front of it. Very good answer. Often several centimetres in depth. Yeah, more than if you're going through my tummy. CAT scans use tomography to gather information on X-ray attenuation. No. Well, the CAT scan is a tomographic image. On X-ray attenuation that can be organized into slices. Wow. This produces a clearer image as there's no superposition of other layers. I think they get there eventually, but okay, let's move on. The last question. Functional imaging techniques allow assessment of the way the body is working. So that's good. Thing that a functional image technique, so it gives you brain activity, gives you the activity and the amount of activity, rather than providing detailed information about the structure. But I can relate these processes used to produce functional medical images to their benefits. Include examples in your answer. So you can think of functional imaging is it's got to be an imaging thing which picks up the functioning of a body part. So it's got to be the fact that the body part is moving. So I suppose you could say that a functional imaging is a Doppler, is a Doppler Doppler scan, a Doppler ultrasonic scan, which I had my old heart valve. But let's do it. You've got functional MRI. So MRI is functional. It operates and is aimed. So one example. So what they're asking is include examples of your. So it's the pr so relate the process used to produce the functional medical images to their benefits. And let's remember that the benefit could be it could be the benefit that you see something that the actual real benefit you want to do is the benefit to the patient. So the benefit to the patient, let's working this back, the benefit to the patient of a functional image is it relates to how their body is working, which gives detailed clinical image to their actual health or lack of health. So functional components can actually say in my heart valve, for instance, the functional ultrasound actually gave an image and actually showed that my little heart valve had come away and it was leaking back and forward. That's very beneficial by actually showing it as. And the process used to do that is looking at the Doppler speed, not only the actual ultrasonic detail, but actually the frequency shift. Okay, I think I've done that. Another functional technique could be, I'll do a few, is there's PET scan, proton emission tomography, and this one is attached to a sugar, and the sugar, the fluorine 18, it is, I think it is, yeah, fluorine 18. It's oxygen, and the neutrons knocked out by proton. Yeah, it's fluorine 18. So fluorine 18 produces goes to the tumor site, produces a two gamma rays, one going in one direction, one in the other. You have coincident gamma ray detectors which locate the orientation of your tumor, so your tumors glow like anything with the PET scan. So that has the advantage, the benefit, that process producing it gives a location on an organ which has the benefit of you seeing the cancer and treating it. A similar type of thing, which is image producing a functional image. Another thing would be technetium-99, that metastable TC99M. So it's important that you do M because the 99 is your ground state, M is the excited state. You could put an asterisk there if you're a nuclear physicist. And that goes to a bone site, and so if you can actually, technetium-99 goes to bone sites, or you can put other things. I've had my son had a technetium-99 cow, a molybdenum cow came in. Not cow, it's a little thing, but that went on his kidney, just to measure the kidney. I don't know why that was quite an amazing process to happen. Yeah, so the radioisotope marker goes to the site, and then you have conventional image, a functional image which makes the actual organ glow. Again, this showed how well the actual organ was operating, how it's functioned. So that's the advantage of it. So let's read what they've read. And this may not be as bad. This is a bit of a thing. Oh well, there you go. Answers could include Doppler ultrasound. Look, that's a bit unfair because I had the Doppler ultrasound. I wouldn't have actually picked it up. And F functional MRI. And I did I mention that? Yeah. Well, they did a functional MRI in my brain looking for. I've had every test, probably $1 million worth of tests done on me, on my brain to look at for the strokes and stuff like that. This is. And the functional MRI in my brain wasn't your standard functional MRI, which was looking for spins at short income. Basically, you can do an angiogram because the blood flows in. The blood coming in or flowing through is a higher contrast because it hasn't been hit, or it's been hit by a particular frequency, and then it flows into a field. So it's actually excited at one point, and then while it's been excited at one point, at one frequency, it flows into a frequency which it glows. It's actually quite an amazing thing to see. Let's read what they say. PET scans and bone scans use gamma radiation, are two functional imaging techniques. Great on them. That's grant that they are two techniques and they're both functional. Two, correct. In both these, the uptake of radioisotopes used to produce the images is dependent on how the body is working, which that's a clear way of saying. In PET, for example, right, I don't think that's necessary. The uptake of an injected radioisotope is greater in, for the example, of brain tumours. In the healthy tissue, and so tumours can be detected on images produced from the radiation emitted from the radioisotope. In bone scans, molecules tagged with gamma-emitting technetium-99m accumulate in tumours and on in the bone, and a benefit for the abnormal tissue can be detected clearly on the bone scan images. Functional images techniques can make abnormal processes that cannot be detected using structural scans visible. That's actually a very good thing. Thus allowing the early detection of a more effective treatment, which is good that they've actually got what the benefit is, as opposed to structural imaging.